Jitterbug. Jitterbug.
Dave Faulkner here from the Hoodoo Gurus, and this is My 88.
Listening to My 88. I am so excited to have one of the icons of the Aussie music industry on the line with me right now. He's the lead singer of the Hoodoo Gurus. It is Dave Faulkner. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Very, very fine shape, actually.
Ah, you must be in a really good mood at the moment because there's some big things happening for you guys. You are celebrating 40 years of your debut album, Stone Age Romeos. That must be really exciting.
It is exciting because we're getting it out on vinyl again with a picture disc and a live album as part of it, and it's all very kind of special and we're feeling a bit pretty nice at the moment.
Yeah, I bet. And the whole vinyl revolution's a really exciting thing, isn't it?
It's great. You know, people have suddenly realised, hey, this sounds really good, which we've been saying for years, but people got confused by the mixed signals they were hearing about, oh, modern technology is always better, but sometimes not necessarily.
Yeah, and there's some exciting things on the 40th anniversary release as well, including a special edition at 1985 live at the Chevron. That must be exciting.
At 1984, actually.
Sorry, 1984.
Yeah, 1984 live at the Chevron. It was a concert we did, and that was the Stone Age Romeo's lineup of the band, obviously, because that's the year the album came out. And we did a show for the ABC called Rock Arena. It was filmed and recorded, but we've gone back to the original tapes and we found some songs that were never aired. Plus, we did a little bit of extra work on the audio to make it sound schmick. And it's a limited release only. This whole thing, this package is going to be only 1,984 copies on the vinyl. Yeah. And this is not going to be digital. Like you won't be able to hear this album on streaming. It's just going to be for people that buy the vinyl, or else you can buy a CD version. That won't be so limited that, people don't buy CDs anymore, do they?
That's exactly right.
I do. I still buy CDs. I love CDs, but, I love vinyl and CDs. I mean, as long as it's something physical I can hold and, keep in my house, I'm happy.
Yes, yeah. Well, I did the whole, I had vinyl, then I went to CDs, then I went to MP3s, now I've gone back to vinyl.
Yeah, well, I have all three going on. I do listen to MP3s, but, I understand that it's just for convenience, not because it sounds that great.
Yes, exactly. Now, how does it feel to look back at the amazing career that you've had?
It's pretty ridiculous, trying to think about how I was 40 years ago and how this all happened ever since. You don't make a plan to have a career in music if you're smart, because there's no guarantee you'll ever, be able to feed yourself, let alone sustain a career for donkey's years like we have. But, when we made this record and when we started the band even, there was no intention of this is for posterity and all that. We literally were just having some fun and it sounded like it. And that's why the record still connects to people, because it's got a certain energy that, is hard to mistake.
So when you first were making the album, you didn't think you'd be celebrating 40 years of it?
No, look, when we got signed to our record deal, everyone laughed in the record industry. They just thought, who's going to sign that band? What are they doing? That's not what people are listening to. They want to have the Thompson Twins and, Human League and all this electronic stuff and, rock and roll and guitars. That was so old-fashioned. Who wants to hear those anymore? That was the idea, anyway, at the time. And everyone was trying to be, go with the times and, sign what the latest thing was. And we weren't the latest thing. We were something kind of out there from somewhere else that didn't belong. And we knew it. We didn't care.
That sounds fantastic. Now, how did the band actually form?
We formed basically because a few of us were at a New Year's Eve party and we'd had a couple of glasses of beer, nothing more strong than that. and we were just talking about music. You know, we all play guitar, and it was like, you know, I like this band, I like this. You know, we talk about the different things that we had in common and the music we liked and were excited by. And we're just saying how there was no bands playing those particular sort of music at the time, you know, in Sydney and where we were. And we just thought, you know, well, let's do it ourselves. And we originally thought we'd be actually playing a lot of cover songs, you know, like, you know, old rock and roll songs and weird stuff that we liked. But once we started rehearsing, we just started writing songs because that's what I do. I'm a songwriter and, you know, I love it. So we just started writing our own songs, and lo and behold, we never bothered learning any covers, and it became, you know, the band you hear now. And those songs, a lot of them ended up on that album.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, looking at your first television appearance, it was on Simon Townsend's Wonderworld. That's pretty iconic.
It was iconic because people don't remember, but, you know, there was no internet, there was no cable TV. So where you got your music, you know, videos from, and, you know, be able to see live music on television was very rare at the time, you know. And you have Countdown on the weekend, and they had Sounds on the weekend as well in the daytime. That was a couple of hours, that show. But for the really obscure stuff, there was nowhere to go to get to hear it or see it. And Simon Townsend's Wonderworld was this kids program, but they often featured up-and-coming, you know, alternative bands. And, you know, and we somehow finagled our way into that show when we didn't have a record out or anything. They didn't know why they were doing a story on it, basically because Kimball, our guitarist, had a friend that worked on the show. And we just had a demo tape, and we used that to perform to in their show. And they made it supposedly about this band, you know, how to form a band and start out the band if you're a kid, you know, how to learn how to do that. But there was nothing educational about it at all. It literally was us, you know, acting like lunatics and, you know, miming to this demo tape we'd recorded, which was a pretty cheesy demo at the time too.
Oh, it must have been a lot of fun though.
It was. And what was funny about it is that we filmed that, and we had never played live yet. So we had this demo we did just, you know, for this show, really, while we did the demo. And then we had booked our first show for like a couple of months away. And by the time the show got to air, because it takes them a long time to, you know, put a program together and they edit the show and all that. And so it was actually, you know, kept being pushed back. So it ended up the episode of Simon Townsend's Wonderworld we were on was the night before, the evening before we played our first gig. So we're on TV before we even played a show. How's that?
Serendipity, I think we'll call that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just shows, you know, we're aiming for the big time straight away.
Now, of course, that album did really well, and you won Best Debut Album at the Countdown Awards. That must have been satisfying and must have given you a bit of hope for the future as well.
Well, not so sure about that. You know, we didn't really think much of Countdown. You know, it was a very popular show, and of course, if you went on there, you know, you were going to have much more commercial success. But we weren't really a natural fit for them. The sort of kids that came to watch the show, they wanted to see people like John Paul Young, and, you know, they're sort of pop idols, and we weren't that sort of band. You know, we didn't look like that, and we didn't play the sort of music that sounded like that either. We weren't that sort of music, so we were an odd fit for them. And the funny thing was, you know, the Countdown Awards that we won that Best Debut Album Award for, was that the favourites were actually Pseudo Echo and Kids in the Kitchen. And we were like the rank outsiders, the third nominee, you know. And when we won, the cameras were on Pseudo Echo because they were so convinced they were going to win. They thought, you know. And so they didn't find we were up on stage before they realised it was, you know, that we were up there. They didn't know where we were in the auditorium. So we finally got on. But it was also a funny thing. The album wasn't, you know, it wasn't a runaway success. It wasn't like overnight, you know, everyone said, oh, what a brilliant record. It kind of took about a year for people to kind of really kind of acknowledge just how good the record was. You know, people liked it, but the more they heard it and the longer they lived with it, the more they realized how much they really liked it, you know, and the album kind of grew. And so it was a sleeper, really. There was no way that it was suddenly like everyone, you know, saying, Hosanna, here's the one, you know, the great debut album by this band. They weren't ready for it.
Well, the next album they must have been ready for, because that did really well. It was your first top five album, Mars Needs Guitars, and it really has become one of those classic 80s albums.
It was, and, you know, and of course, and from the very first single, Bittersweet, that's a song that marked me out as a songwriter, you know, to take seriously. I mean, and the first album was a lot of fun, and we really had, you know, we were often writing songs just to amuse ourselves, but in Bittersweet, I just kind of felt like I wanted to start saying something a bit more, you know, emotionally true, you know, rather than just making up funny stories and singing about them, you know. Some of the first album is kind of comical in places, you know, and So I wanted to be a bit more honest and a bit more, you know, real. So Bittersweet was the thing that sort of signified that change. And then, of course, we had one of our biggest hits on that album was, of course, a song called Like Wow Wipeout, which, again, was more back to the fun, sort of not giving a rats about, you know, who's going to listen to this song or who likes it and what's it for. We just did it as a B-side, thinking this is a bit of, you know, noisy rock and roll fun. And it was only our producer, Charles Fisher, who said, you know, you've got to put this on the record. And then he said, you've got to make that the next single, which we thought he was out of his mind. Because, you know, we thought radio's never going to play that sort of song, because they weren't at that time. And, you know, they were playing all those Human League and all that sort of stuff. But something about that song caught people's attention, and radio loved it, and people loved it. And what do I know? I just write the damn thing.
Now, it was a really big heyday for Aussie music, wasn't it? It must have been such an exciting time to be out recording music and touring.
It was, because, you know, those days, you know, we didn't have the internet. And so if people wanted to meet someone, you know, that they wanted to get closer to or more friendly with, you kind of had to go there in person. You couldn't do it online and swipe left or right, you know? So people would go to a pub on a Tuesday night and, you know, have a good night. And people were going out, you know, 7 days a week, the pubs were working, you know, and they're having live music, because that was what attracted people to go out on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday. It wasn't to go out and get drunk, it was actually to go out and be entertained and to see people having fun and be with them, you know? So that's how it all happened, I reckon, is the fact that, you know, it was like the world's biggest dating site. You'd go see a gig and you'd meet people that have the same kind of attitude to life as you do by the sort of music they like. So that's how it worked. And that worked across the board. It wasn't like there was any particular style of music. There was everything you could think of, you know, was playing lots of gigs. You know, it was where there's really underground sort of alternative, you know, music that never went anywhere and never got on the radio, to stuff that was really hard rock that, you know, again, was, you know, not popular on radio either. Like, it was everything. It was just a really great time to go out and see live music. And unfortunately, a lot of that's gone away because people's, you know, time is less, you know, less time, free time. And also we've got more, I don't know, it seems like people work harder now and they have more bills. You know, we never had the internet to pay for, the mobile phones and all these other things that never used to exist. So maybe we had a bit more disposable income to go out and have a good time and meet a few people and have a few laughs.
Yeah, definitely. Now, your next album did even better. Blow Your Cool got to number 2 on the Aussie charts. You also had a second number 2 album in 1994. Oh, almost got to that top spot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we've never had number 1, but, you know, what does that matter, you know? All we care about is the songs, you know, whether the songs are good and whether they resonate with people. And that's the biggest, you know, tick for me, is that people are still talking about some of these songs and still, you know, enjoying them to this day.
Yeah.
So yeah, Blow Your Cool was a big album. I've got to say, for us personally, it was a difficult time. We didn't really enjoy making that record because the producer wasn't really on our wavelength, and for me, the sound of that record is the most 80s sounding, for want of a better word. It doesn't kind of, you know, it doesn't. The other ones don't sound quite as tied to that time and place as that one does. So you know, that was one thing that I kind of regret, is that we didn't, you know, maybe get a different producer or, you know, do something else differently at that time.
Now, speaking of number ones, though, you did incredibly well on the US college charts. Your first 4 albums all went to number 1 there. That must have been quite surreal.
Yeah, that's an airplay thing. And basically, you know, now we all know about things like alternative music and, you know, like underground, whatever you want to call it, you know, that thing. But in those days, it was a very new thing that, you know, it hadn't broken into the mainstream yet. You know, that took it, it had to wait until something like Nirvana came along and made the alternative suddenly mainstream. But until that time, it was really almost like 2 worlds, and there was commercial music and then there was the underground music, and we were part, you know, closer to that. Even though we had hits in Australia in the mainstream, in America we were still a alternative artist. And so that meant that we were being played on those sort of stations, and that those sort of stations ranged from everything from a, you know, community radio and you know, in a shopping center, to a university that was training, you know, technicians to be working in radio professionally. You know, like it was a whole different range of stations, like thousands of them all across America. And so that just, those charts represented the airplay that we were getting on all those diversity of stations. And then including, you know, major independent stations, like, you know, your equivalent of what we used to call FM radio in Australia, you know, back in the old days. Was like those sort of stations, you know, major alternative, they'd call them, or commercial alternative. So it was a real cross-section of different styles of programming and size of station. Some were commercial, some were really fiercely independent, you know, and some were just communities, you know. So for whatever reason, you know, we connected to that world, and they gave us a lot of support. We had a lot of fun touring there as well.
Oh, I bet. I'm sure there's after a few drinks, there's a few stories you could tell about the US tours.
A million of them, and we're still going there. We're going there, in fact, this September again. We went there last year and toured in April, May, and we're going again in September to do another tour over there. And it was incredible after all this time to go there and, you know, be playing, you know, 30 shows, you know, 25 shows or something in 30 days. It was ridiculous, and we're doing it again. So we'll be in the bus, you know, and sleeping in the bus bunks there on those little, you know, touring bus, and you know, waking up in the new town every day. Wow. Getting ready to play.
That must be exciting.
It is cool, actually. I mean, you know, funnily enough, you know, I thought I wouldn't handle it, you know, because I'm, you know, older and a little bit less resilient than you are on your kid, and you can do anything, and, you know, you can put them in the, you know, put them in the boot almost, you know, be comfortable enough to sleep, you know. But now I need my creature comforts, and, you know. But no, I took to it like a duck to water, and we all did. We loved it. So we're looking forward to it.
That sounds amazing. Now, your songs, you've mentioned quite a few of your iconic songs. Your biggest success came with What's My Scene, which is a really fun song, fun music video as well. Do you look back at that one quite fondly?
Look, that's a song I'm really proud of. As a songwriter, you know, I think it expresses everything I try to do in writing a song, you know, technically speaking. You know, I just love the melody of that and the way it just keeps, you know, There's almost like two choruses, really. There's the first bit, you know, that happens at the end of a verse, and then the real chorus comes in later. You think that first bit was enough for a real chorus, but there's an even more exciting chorus later, and then there's a bridge section that I also love. It's so catchy and melodic, and, you know, it just jumps out, you know, all the time. It just leaps out at you, that song. And lyrically, too, you know, the lyrics are really clever, but at the same time, they're very, you know, meaningful to me, and they still, you know, express things I feel, which is, where the hell do I fit in? You know, I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Now, your music has been used in pretty amazing places, such as the rugby league and Thank God You're Here. That must be quite humbling as well.
Well, it's good for the bank balance too.
Well, especially with it coming back this past year, Thank God You're Here.
So, no, look, for me, from the very beginning, like we had an indication that things like that could happen early on, which, you know, was a real sort of, you know, eye-opener, was when we did the song My Girl. We made a video for that with like a greyhound featuring in it, like a greyhound race. And funnily enough, you know, we heard a story around that time that at the local greyhound meeting, they suddenly said, and now a song by the Hoodoo Gurus. And they played this our song over their little, you know, the little TVs that all the betting rings, you know, they took 3 minutes, you know, 4 minutes out from all the betting to play a video of a song, which never happens. And we just thought, this is really strange. You know, this band is going to places that I could never imagine. You know, you expect to have, you know, music fans come out and see you and, you know, pay money and come to your show. But out in the real world where people are doing their everyday lives and, you know, your music's there as part of their lives, that was a real sort of surprise to me. And, you know, it's kept on going ever since, as you say. You know, like we've had, you know, the rugby league use what's my scene is that's my theme, and other things. You know, the Navy used 1,000 Miles Away for you know, campaign as well, and has been involved in one of the ships used it as their ship song. Just incredible things that you could never expect. And, you know, that's the beauty of music, I guess. It's, you know, people relate to it and it connects their lives in funny ways.
Yeah. Now, the band was honoured in 2007 by getting into the ARIA Hall of Fame. How was that for you?
I actually was going to say no when it first got offered, because the ARIA has never nominated us for any prizes before that. We never got nominated for, you know, Best Single or Best Album or anything like that. We got Best Artwork nomination once. Didn't win it, but we got for the artwork. Not really the same thing as, you know, having your music, you know, get in the nomination. So we were a little bit funny about them. You know, we thought, they don't get us, you know. And I actually almost wanted to say no, but then I thought, oh, don't be an idiot. You know, this is kind of significant. You know, this is honouring our whole career and, you know, and also for our family and friends, you know, to see us being recognised was also a big thing for them as well. You know, they've gone through a lot, you know, putting up with us being on tour and stuff as well. So, and it was a very special moment too, you know, for me personally. When I went up there, I felt, you know, incredibly proud to be up there with these four blokes, you know, the four of us together, and seeing what we've done together and having a moment to reflect on that was, Yeah, you don't get to do that very often, so I did love it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, everyone does need to get a copy of the vinyl for Stone Age Romeos. It is out on the 17th of May. Dave Faulkner, thank you so much for chatting today.
Thank you so much. And yeah, go and put your pre-orders in because it's going to sell out. There's only 1,984 copies to go out for the number of the year it came out. So 1,984 copies of the vinyl. If you want one, better go online and order it now because it might not be there at May 17. It might be too late.
That sounds absolutely perfect. This is My 88.